This is Sydney. You're listening to Toenails. We're starting today's episode with Devin.
I've said I'm a romantic before, and I'm a romantic about running. And I think in part I'm a romantic about running because I think it's a really apt metaphor for a life.
Devin is a writer and a school teacher and a runner in New York.
To go for like one single run is to sort of enact on like a really tiny scale part of what it feels like to be alive. The magic of going further than you thought you could, the heartbreak of feeling fragile. There's hubris involved in running. There's those days when you think you can go faster than you ever could and you're brought down. And there's also the opposite, like where your hubris is rewarded, like you go for it and you're somehow flying. And so to share in that with anyone is why I think it is like there's a deepness I have to almost any relationship I have that has involved running in some way.
I reached out to Devin Kelly when I first started reporting this episode about the feeling of running with other people. Our conversation took a different turn and we ended up talking a lot about his brother. I'm sharing parts of that conversation here to kick us off.
My first experience with running was spectating. I would show up at the races with my dad and there was this assistant coach on our track team or on our cross country team who was training to become a priest, Father Hurley, I think. And I would just sort of be his buddy, like him and I, we would run around the course and take all the splits, you know, for the whole team and on like a piece of paper. And I loved doing that so much. I loved hearing the gun go off and like watching the race and be like, okay, they started and we start our stopwatches and then we sprint to like the mile marker and we wait there and we see everyone pass and then we run through the woods to get to the second mile marker. And there was something about that I really loved.
But what Devin loved most of all was just watching his brother run.
And the reason I hope that running was something he grew to cherish and find solace in was that like I found a great deal of comfort and solace in watching him run. My brother and I, we grew up really close by virtue of the fact that he was my only sibling. We did everything together as kids. My brother's a year and a half older than me, and so I would play with him. I'd play like with the older kids and just so I could be on his team. And when we played baseball, like he was the pitcher and I was the catcher and like we were a tag team. Like we did that for so long, for a really long time in our lives.
But back at home, things were a little different.
You know, in a movie, my brother and I would be up all night talking about our mom being an alcoholic and would, you know, I don't know, like we would be doing all sorts of things together. We'd be going on runs together as 14-year-old kids through the neighborhood, and none of that happened. It always strikes me a little bit weird that we didn't, that like when he was lacing up to go for a run when we were both 15, that I didn't say, hey, I'll come with you. Like that never happened. Like it's so crazy. It really is. I think what happened is that we both processed the trauma of our childhood in probably wildly different ways. And both happened to really love doing this one thing that we did separately until we started to do it together. You know, my parents' divorce and my mom's addiction, the way I processed it, which was largely on my own, that's what made me, I don't know if I wanted to become a writer, but it's what made me write. Like I kept journals not long after that, and like almost every single thing I wrote in a journal had something to do with that moment.
But Tom seemed to handle things differently.
My brother, he didn't turn to art the same way I turned to art. And so I think a great sadness is that I don't know the extent to which he processed that or how he processed what happened. And the only thing I know he did was run. And he ran fast and far and like beautifully.
And that began the sports mythology of the Kelly family. It makes me think that that was like the castle for the three of you. Those were formative experiences of you three coming together and like really having like a space for yourselves.
That was, I like that you said castle, like that was sort of our sacred place, was wherever my brother or I were running and, mm-hmm. and my dad being there.
And this is how it went for a long time. Devin and Tom on these parallel tracks, separated by place or age or trauma, until finally they ran together.
The experience of running with my brother for the first time, I remember it because it was such an opening of the door to our relationship. I think in part for me, it was like this missing puzzle piece in this grand sort of narrative of our lives. Like I said before, that there was this thing that we both shared that we never shared together. I remember distinctly running in Van Cortlandt with him on the cinder path that hugs the main part of the park. They have a big cinder loop, and I can hear the footsteps right now, the sort of like a crunch of it on the feet, and I can hear his breathing, and I don't even have to close my eyes to picture him next to me, you know, and where his body would be, and I know what his stride looks like. I know what the side of his face looks like, because you look at it for so long. He's always like right a little bit ahead of me. I'm always like 2 inches behind him. He usually, his arms ride a little high and he sort of bounces his arms a little bit. He's got like really active shoulders when he runs, and like a really short arm carriage, like short, high and tight. And a short stride too. And I run, I think, a little bit more hunched over and lean forward, and he carries his back a little higher. And so we definitely have different strides. But I think they would know. I would imagine most people would be like, yeah, those are brothers. I hope they would know. It's a feeling that conjures up more when you ask, like, what's the first memory of running with your brother? It's this feeling of being side by side. It's not like this story of us like running up a mountain. It's just like we're together and our feet are landing together and our breath is breathing together.
My favorite memories of running are those shared with other people. And I love how Devin's story highlights the intimacy of that experience. In making this episode, I was first interested in exploring these feelings just in the sphere of running. But this feeling exists outside of running too. At a rave, a church, maybe at a protest, there is a point where your individual experience dissolves into the collective, where the sounds and movements and feelings of others register as extensions of your own. Though activities like these, that I'll describe as communal movement throughout this episode, have been studied by scientists and historians for centuries, they have never quite been accepted into Western culture. In 2006, the late, great nonfiction writer Barbara Ehrenreich wrote Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. This is a book I will quote from heavily throughout this episode. In it, Ehrenreich explains that this hostility towards communal movement began in the early 1700s with European colonizers' opinions of the ecstatic group rituals performed by the indigenous peoples they visited and nearly destroyed. This sense of self-loss and ecstasy indigenous peoples were able to create through the movement of the group was, to the European colonialists, a defining feature of their, quote, savagery, and otherness. The capacity to lose oneself in the group signaled, to them, a weakness of the mind. This view, in turn, told the Europeans something important about themselves. Europeans felt that this ability to resist the temptation to dance or move with the group meant that there was something essentially superior about their mind. Can someone say eugenics? Unfortunately, this view had staying power. So, like a cheer squad constantly pushing back against a police barricade at a marathon, this antagonizing relationship between a ruling class and the people who want to move is a consistent, if not central, dynamic throughout human history. For at least 5,000 years, it seems that every phase of civilization has been shaped by its own campaign to dismantle collective celebration. But it's not just because the people in power hate parties, though they might. Throughout history, outlawing communal movement has been an essential tactic in efforts to maintain class divides, further colonialism, and more recently, embed capitalism into our culture. And it worked. After centuries of continuous repression and rebellion, free, spontaneous, organic movement of people is almost completely eradicated from modern society. We have now gone from a highly festive and communal social life to our current, highly repressed and isolated society that barely moves together and is satisfied with a few corporate pay-to-play holidays every year. How do we get here, and what does running have to do with all of this? Stay with me. There is a dearth of interesting writing about running and sports in general, so instead I search elsewhere. For this episode, I was reading a lot about the history of ancient Greek and Roman cults, also about the evolution of medieval carnivals, and a little bit about 90s rave culture. Sure. The ability to move together in time may have evolved as a necessary trait for a group's survival, hunting down prey, defending themselves from neighbors and whatnot, but that stopped being a good enough reason to run thousands of years ago. From a purely evolutionary angle, running, dancing, and moving together is a garish and gregarious waste of resources. Because we have stopped hunting, but have continued to do these other activities, I'm interested in this episode in the way communal movement serves a deeper spiritual or broader societal need. So really, I don't think that connecting running to these types of activities, ancient religious rituals and ecstatic dance, is that much of a stretch. In the right setting, a run with other people can feel like a collective celebration or a worship. And I'm not alone in this. These are the comparisons other runners make too, when you ask them. Are there other experiences that you've had in your life that bring about that similar kind of widening of the lens, like you said, that kind of like reminds you of the collective experience?
Yeah, I think a lot about music.
Devin Kelly again.
I used to go to concerts all the time in college and after. And I always thought that a concert was like one of those few moments in life of that same non-judgment and celebration. Because no one, I think, reacts to music in the same way. And how you appreciate music, I think, can't be judged, right? Like, you don't look to the person next to you and say, like, why aren't you moving your arms like that? Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you don't say, like, why aren't you moving your arms, or why are you? It's just like, no, you absolutely, like, you let yourself experience that moment in a way that is really entirely your own, but you also are sharing it with someone. Someone is next to you. It's not entirely alone. And I think running amongst people is similar too, because when you run amongst people, you also bear witness to a kind of suffering or a kind of joy that is wholly someone else's, but you share in that as well. Like, you're traveling the miles together.
Beyond concerts, I've heard running crews described as cults and Sunday long runs with a few friends described as going to church. And these comparisons are beautiful, but to me, they are more than just metaphors. They're foreshadowing. These lively communal experiences are not so prominent in our lives anymore. They have been continuously chipped away by the sculpting hand of a growing, modernizing world. Yes, you may go to church on the weekend sometimes, or to a party every couple weeks or months, but these are achingly hollow and infrequent renditions of a public life that was once full and profound. Take, for example, and this is my favorite fun fact from all of my research, that in 15th century France, every 1 in 4 days was a citywide carnival. 1 in 4! But with the advent of capitalism, elites saw holidays as wasted labor. And so, through a series of systematic changes, communal celebrations were culled from early modern life. And I fear the same thing could happen to running. History repeats itself, and from my vantage point, the fate of running is linked to the dismal fate of group activities like these that have come before. If we're not careful, your open and organic and weird and contradictory running crew could become a weekly Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, a spectacle marching through the streets but not really going anywhere. And as much as all of us kind of low-key want free shoes, I know none of us want that. But the story is not over. People are still running, more and more every day, and running is still very weird. So take this episode as less of a story of doom and gloom and more of a cautionary tale, an allegory from 5,000 years ago. And the story starts with a snowy night in December. Women of all ages were seen running through the town, their housework abandoned and their children left at home. The women had heard the call. One by one, these maenads, as they were named, ran through the town into the forest, yelling and tossing their long trailing hair as they began to find one another together in the dark. They have been called by the god Dionysus, or Bacchus, as he is known by the Romans. And while his mundane jurisdiction covered vineyards and wine, his more spiritual responsibility was to preside over the orgeia, literally, rites performed in the dark, and the basis for our modern word orgy, during which his devotees of all genders danced themselves into a trance. This was one such night. It was the night of the Oribasha, the most notorious form of Dionysian worship, performed exclusively by women, often in the dead of winter. Dressed only in fawn skins, the Maenads summited the 8,000-foot peak of Mount Parnassus in central Greece. An incredibly impressive athletic achievement, especially in the dead of winter. Once there, they danced and drank until they reached communion with Dionysus, a state of mind the Greeks called enthusiasmos, literally, having the god within oneself. It is also the basis for our modern word enthusiasm. The ultimate goal of this ecstatic ritual was to be temporarily released from the horror of individual existence into the mystical oneness through the rhythmic unity of dance. Dionysian cult rituals like this, this madness that was the cure to madness, are some of the most well-documented early instances of collective celebration that we have in history. And what happens next provides an archetype for how they fall. Dionysus, who has been compared to other gods like Pan, Cybele, and Shiva, was an accessible and democratic deity. And perhaps this was his first mistake. As the concept of social hierarchy took hold in Greek and Roman life, danced rituals of the archaic past were seen as a direct threat to that dominant social order. That was because traditional festivities and ecstatic rituals, as Ehrenreich explains, had a leveling effect. They allowed anyone from any race or gender or political or social status to enjoy direct inspiration from the gods. These unsupervised ecstatic gatherings posed an obvious problem for a fledgling caste system whose class divides were maintained through disempowering violence. Speaking of violence, along with social hierarchy came the rise of militarism and war. And the desire for military preparedness was fundamentally at odds with the peace-loving anti-war god Dionysus. In the face of potential prohibition, the Greeks took their Dionysian rituals underground into secret societies. But no such luck for Dionysus's Roman brother Bacchus, because the Romans took a hard-ass stance. Militarism won out in Roman life, and not only did the Romans vanquish Bacchus, who at this point was also reduced to just a fun-loving god of wine, but they also sought to stigmatize the core tenets of ecstatic rituals themselves. Citing Aaron Reich again, it is in Roma that the Greek word orgeia, for ecstatic rituals performed at night, takes on its modern, often negative connotations of grossness and excess. Too much food, drink, and sex performed indulgently and irresponsibly. Similarly, the Greek word ecstasis, a forerunner to ecstasy, often gets translated into Latin at this time as superstition, rather than its previous interpretation as stepping outside of oneself. We also see the closing of dance schools for children and the remaking of the Roman religion into a cold and prosaic affair designed to reinforce the social hierarchy. In a perfect union of church and state, men of noble rank were appointed to perform religious rites, and the emperor, Augustus, declared himself a god. And in 168 BCE, the war against communal movement culminated with a violent crackdown on any remaining followers of Bacchus and Dionysus. 7,000 men and women were detained, the majority of them executed, men by the state and women handed over to their families to be killed in private. The resulting impression of this multi-pronged campaign is that there would be no communal thrills in Roman life, other than those sponsored and staged by the powerful, like circuses and the gladiatorial games. Any desire to access something bigger than yourself, or even just to commune with your peers, had to be mediated by the state, who were also apparently gods, but who were really just rich. Okay, so what does all this mean? This story of the suppression of Dionysian cults is one of the original examples of how subcultures go extinct. And while the intensity of suppression varies from group to group, obviously not every subculture faces genocide, the plotline throughout history seems to remain largely the same. Self-actualization is at the top of our hierarchy of needs. It is the carrot dangled by the powerful to make us play by their rules. So, when a group can achieve that self-actualization outside of those rules, the powerful, afraid of losing their carrot, commandeer that access by infiltrating the group and controlling their methods. This is the cycle that comes up again and again throughout history. Take, for example, right after the fall of paganism, which we just heard about, there was the rise of Christianity. Early Christianity was full of dancing and singing and trance. But after just a few centuries, religious authorities banned dancing, invented pews to make you sit your ass down, and introduced tedious, highly choreographed services. And then again, after that, when churches banned dancing, the public invented carnivals to compensate. But those faced the same fate. In some places, the suppression was quick, by not allowing a permit for a festival, while in others, it was more piecemeal. Either way, this wave of reform spread across Europe with literally thousands of acts of legislation, all designed to remove communal celebration from daily life. This was all because of the advent of capitalism. There was money to be made from reliable, well-regulated human labor, and to the men who stood to make it, the old recreations and pastimes represented the waste of a valuable resource. Beyond these very historical examples, you don't have to look that far into the past or even around you in the present to see examples of other subcultures that have been co-opted or streamlined in a similar way. Think of the way the Stonewall Riots has been somehow memorialized into a sterilized corporate pride parade, or the way underground raves have continued to get shut down and priced out of cities in favor of blindingly homogenous bougie nightclubs. These examples show up again and again throughout history, so much so that it makes me think that maybe this is just the way things are. Honestly, after reading and researching this kind of stuff for months, I just felt pretty dejected. Like, maybe this is just it. Running culture, like all wild and weird subcultures that came before, maybe it's just doomed to some type of sterilized future. And this is where I was kind of at in my research until sometime in August. And it's then that I get this text from Dan Merritt, who's the head of marketing at Ciel. Ciel is the brand that pays for this podcast, and I've worked with them on and off for nearly 10 years. First as a photographer and now making this show. In this text message, Dan asked me if I wanted to go to Toronto in October for Bridge the Gap. Bridge the Gap, for the uninitiated, is a gathering of urban running crews that happens in different cities around the world, generally coordinated around big races or anniversaries. I went to my first Bridge the Gap in New York for the anniversary of Bridge Runners, a New York running crew, when I was just 19. I have been to several other Bridge the Gaps since then. It's a super special thing, and it totally blew my brain open at a very young age. And it embedded me into this running culture and helped me make friends all over the world because of it. But I haven't really been actively a part of running crew culture in probably about 5 years. For reasons you'll hear a bit more about later on, but also for all the reasons that I interrogate in this podcast. Running culture has changed, and not always in ways that I like. And I spend a lot of time thinking about why. So it was in the middle of what felt like an endless, depressing slog of research that basically told me running was doomed, that this opportunity came around to be thrown right back into running crew culture and see what it feels like to run with other people now. So I hopped on a plane and headed to Toronto. Next time on Toenails, what happens in Toronto? This episode was written, produced, and hosted by me, Sydney Allen Ash, with story editing support by Daniela Barreto. Audio editing by me, and original music by Young Clancy. All of our promotional videos are made by Marvin Lau. Thanks for listening.